The subject this morning is spiritual leadership, and so we're going to cover this from the point of view of where you are, where I am, really. Spiritual leadership right at home and in the family, and where we are. This morning I was reminded again of how grateful I am for that trip to Iowa that I made when I first came back to the States, Bud, and I think we were meeting, I don't know if this is in Minneapolis or in your office in Iowa, but one of the things that was presented was this Bible reading plan. And as long as I've been a Christian, I've never been successful at reading through the Bible in a year. But you gave these out and gave a little pep talk, and just another illustration of how the Lord sends you somewhere to speak or to be part of a conference, and you usually get more than you give. And that's exactly what happened, because this little thing has just been a real blessing and a help to me in getting through the Bible. And so far, I'm up to date. This morning, I read Jeremiah chapter 35 and 36, so I'm really grateful for that trip. I wonder if you've ever bought a piece of equipment or a household appliance, and you get it home and the first thing you do is plug it in or crank it up and you begin to press all the buttons, and after a few moments there begins to be a funny smell and the thing begins to get hot and you quick unplug it, and that's where this little saying comes into effect. When all else fails, read the manufacturer's handbook. The thing you should have done, first of all, is find out what the manufacturer said you're supposed to do before you even plug it in. My son has just bought a motorcycle, and I've learned by now, after 42 years of this life, that the first thing you do, you check with what the manufacturer says is the first things you're supposed to do. So he had to read that handbook from front to back and from back to front, although he was tempted to crank it up and, you know, take it around the block first. But, you know, life is too short for us not to check with the manufacturer's handbook. Your relationship with your wife is too precious to experiment with. Raising your children and the lives of your children are just too precious and too unique. And as that advertisement says, that the song that you remind us, that you've only got one time around, and I would suggest instead of living it with gusto, let's suggest that people live it according to the way the manufacturer said it's supposed to be lived. And so in this area of the family, because it is so precious, because it is so even so easy to break, I feel we better stick with what God has given us in the Bible as the way these things should be done and the way that life should be lived. And I want to take this approach to spiritual leadership this morning. Not necessarily your leadership in ministry, in the church, in business, but I think really where it pays off, right in your own home, with your own wife, with your own husband, with your own children. I think that if you'll just use a little bit of imagination and common sense, you'll also see that these things apply just in your day-to-day church relationships, or even in your business relationships, because leadership is leadership, whether it's spiritual or whether it's in the secular world. The first area I want to talk about is the husband and wife. I came home with Ruth from a conference, and as usual at this conference, they'd had a big session for the wives on how to be good wives, and I think the men during that time played softball. And this has happened a number of times, and this is what happens. Ruth, with tears running down her cheeks, says, "We're always studying to be better wives, and you never really work on being better husbands." True, isn't it? I don't know how many sessions I've sent Ruth off to learn to be a better wife, but very little is said. So this morning, I just want to talk about the husband as the leader in the home, not just the spiritual leader, but the leader. And I just want to suggest Ephesians 5 as a text. There are many.
And if we're open to them, I think that no matter where we're reading, usually at some point in the epistles, especially, we will come across some exhortation to the husband. But I think, husband, if you're going to be a leader in your home, the place to start is verse 25 and 26. And I alluded to this yesterday. What I'm going to do is, as we go along, I want to give Ruth just a chance to chime in with anything that maybe I've left out, or maybe something that she feels would be helpful to underline from the wife's point of view. And I think maybe I should comment. We didn't really dress like this on purpose this morning, except now that we are both in black and white, we could probably say, well, it's all here before you this morning in black and white. Ephesians 5, 25 and 26. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Even so, husbands should love their wives as their own body. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no man ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. This is a great mystery, and I take it to mean Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. We often hear talks on wives, submit to your husband. And I believe this is necessary teaching. The word submit, as it is used in verse 23 and 24, the wife is to submit to her husband. The word there is paraphrased in some translations, adapt. So it is not just conveying the idea that the woman is the slave of the husband. And I think it's important that we read that whole passage in context, because if anyone is to sacrifice themselves in the marriage relationship, it is the husband, not the wife. Because the husband's example is Christ. And what does it say that he did for the church? He gave himself up for it. He died for it. Not thinking of his own needs, but thinking of our needs. So the word submit does mean the idea that the wife is to adapt to her husband. But I feel it's important that we as men should do our part in fulfilling what God has given us to do. And I think as we do that, we're not going to have to go to our wives and say, now look, Ruth, this passage says that you're supposed to submit to me. I feel that as I am doing my part, this gives me the right to have my wife adapt and build her program and her life around what God is leading me to do. Husbands, love your wives just like Christ loved the church and gave himself up for it. I feel that as I do my part, then I can expect, and even I find that Ruth does willingly and gladly adapt to me. Is not this how Christ wins my allegiance? It's not just by the big club. It's not just by pointing and saying, now you will obey me. But frankly, as I look at what he did for me, I can't think of any other course of action than to willingly and loyally submit and adapt myself to his will for me. I have no other course of action. His love has so won me that he does not have to say, or he does not have to use the instrument of fear. Husband, love your wife in every sense that it means love and sacrifice and giving. And I'll have something more to say about that in just a moment. Then I think also, as well as loving your wife, we're given the great privilege of leading our wives. Verse 23, the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. God has given me the great privilege of leading my wife, being her head. Now, you have the authority to lead your wife. You have every right to lead your wife and to expect her to submit. But if you have to invoke it every once in a while, it seems to me that this is just an indication that you are not really fulfilling your part. Do you remember how Jesus led his disciples? He had every authority to bark out orders and to expect them to be fulfilled. He was the Creator. He had every right just to expect that everything he said would be automatically and immediately done. But do you remember how Jesus led those men? He said, and I believe Lee Brace would have touched upon this yesterday, I, the Son of Man, came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. Here was the great Creator of the universe, the Lord of all the earth, and he said, I didn't come just to be served and worshipped and honored and respected. I came to give worship, or to give service, and to give honor, and to give respect to others. And what did he do near the end of his life? Took off his clothes, girded himself with a towel, got a basin of water, and went around to the disciples and washed their feet. I think it's important that we realize that our wives are people. I'm going to have something to say about this relating to our children. Your wife is a person. This is why I think that verse 21 is so important in Ephesians 5. Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. Not only are you, wife, to be subject to your husband, but husband, just because your wife is another Christian, you're supposed to, in a sense, be subject to her as well. She's a person. I wonder if when you come home at night, do you turn off your Christian patience? Or when you get in the house on the weekends, is that the end of your trying to get along with other people? Giving them all due respect? It really comes home to me from time to time when I realize that when I'm with you, I listen very carefully. I would not think of reading the newspaper while you're talking to me. But when I get home, I'm tempted, to do things that I would never do to any other person. Just because it's my family. It's my wife. She's a person. And we need to treat her with as much respect and as much patience and with as great a display of love and understanding as we would any other person. In other words, when you come home, don't just turn it off. Be subject to one another out of reverence for Jesus Christ. Now, I think in this whole matter of leading, the husband is the head, but the husband has that final decision to make. It is his decision. Marriage is not a democracy. Two heads are a monstrosity. You don't each have a vote. Now, I think the husband must take counsel from the wife. I mean, he's a dope if he doesn't. There's no businessman among you who will go ahead on a project without getting advice from the experts in the field. I mean, there are maybe many businessmen who do that, but they're not in business very long. Well, your wife is an expert in many, many fields. Take advice from her. Get her counsel. But I'm afraid the monkey's on your back, husband. That final decision about money matters, about the children, about the house, about vacations, about savings, about giving, all of those decisions, they rest upon you. Now, I think you're a fool if you make those decisions without getting advice from your wife. I just frankly think you're going to end up wrecking anything you go into if you don't take her counsel and her advice and weigh it very carefully. But wife, that final decision belongs to him, and I think you've got to give him the encouragement to make those final decisions. Don't let him let you make the final decisions. Take his advice, or take her advice, listen to it,
and then make the final decision, husband. That's your responsibility. And you wives, just be sure you give him plenty of leeway in doing that so that he doesn't feel the pressure of, well, if I don't decide it her way, then there's going to be a stone-cold silence for the rest of the week. The final decision is yours. But as I say, this is a relationship of love. And the husband leads as the head of his wife because he is willing to lay down his life and give up everything for her good. I think how this works out in practice is this. When I come home at night, I remember in our first year of married life, I would walk in the door and I would just wait for Ruth to say, "I love you," or something to indicate her devotion and her love to me. And sometimes it didn't come. And I would resent it and get bitter, and bitter might be a bit strong, but I would get a little bit discouraged about it. Until I realized what Ephesians 5:25 was saying. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for it. Jesus didn't wait for me to respond to him before he died on the cross. He gave himself up even before there was a response from me. So I began, when I came home, I began thinking, well, now the first thing I want to do is tell Ruth I love her. I want to, instead of thinking about my needs, my need for encouragement, my need for love, I've got to think about what she needs. And when I walk in the door, I'm not going to have her minister to me, because I'm supposed to be like Christ to her. And Christ came into this world not to be ministered to, but to minister and to give his life as a ransom for many. So I, right early on in our marriage, decided that when I came in the door, I was going to beat her to it. And you know what I find? She says she loves me all the time. I don't have to always wait for it. Then I think there's something that needs to be said in our leadership, husbands, about this whole matter of delegation and getting counsel and advice. I think there are things that you need to let your wife do. Now, I don't have a very good head for figures. So I don't write the checks in our family. I don't feel that I'm necessarily giving up my responsibility by letting Ruth do that or asking her to do it, because she's had a lot of experience in bookkeeping. And however, I can make decisions. You know, I can flip a coin and say, well, we will go on a vacation this year instead of buying a refrigerator. I feel I can make decisions, and that's my responsibility. Well, I don't feel that I have to, therefore, write all the checks, do all the bookkeeping. That's something that she can do better than I can. I don't think that necessarily means that I'm not the leader, because I do find that I can make the decisions. And she encourages me to do that, and she helps me do that by giving me plenty of advice. And, you know, I think when I make decisions, I've got to weigh her feelings and her desires very heavily. Right now, we're facing this decision. Do we think about spending money on something like a vacation? Or do we buy a refrigerator? Well, now, I would really like to have a vacation. That would be my personal desire. But Ruth is the one that has to wrestle with that old fridge that doesn't defrost itself, that she has to defrost. And it's small by American standards, so that, you know, we don't have a big freeze, you know, and all those things that you wives understand. And so how am I going to decide? Well, I've got to decide more in light of what she needs than in the light of what I need, because that's how Christ lived his life for me. He sacrificed and gave up his desires so that I could have eternal life. There's another area, and it's this area of the children. Now, I'm very conscious of what's right and what's wrong. And I've been gone all day. And I come into the house, and I see that the children's clothes are just dropped at the door, and they are not picked up, and things are not really. And I feel the children are beginning to take advantage of us, and they are not being obedient. Because look at, and so my reaction is, Paul and Mark, get in here right away. What's that coat doing down?
Where did you put that? Can't you take it and put it in your room?
Well, I've learned that I've got an expert on children in our home, and it's Ruth. Before I go off half-cocked and start making decisions and putting things right in relationship to the children, I've learned that if I'll just take 5 minutes to get the expert's advice, I might make the right decision.
And so I say, Ruth, what about this? Are we kind of forgetting to help the kids learn how to take care of these things? And she says, well, you know, they came right home from school. And remember, you'd asked them to work on the garden. And so they've gone out, and that's what they're working on. Oh, well, okay, maybe I can wait until they come in to talk to them about that.
And, of course, these are two areas, aren't they? Finances and children, where many marriages, you know, are under constant tension. So I'm not saying that the woman makes the decision or that the woman raises the children. But I'm saying, gentlemen, you have the responsibility to set the tone and make the decisions. But don't forget to get your wife's counsel and your wife's advice.
Now, that's all I'm going to say about the husband and the wife. And I just wonder now, Ruth, is there anything that we've discussed in the last day or two about this that maybe that I should underline or that you would like to illustrate or...
No, I was just going to say that when we're talking about the wife submitting and adapting, back in Navigator days when we first started out in the 50s, it was a big thing, this idea of submitting. And I do like the word adapt because I think it shows that it doesn't mean that I don't have any point of view about anything. And I submit to everything that Ed says because I think this would be a fallacy with any of us. We all have our own ideas, and then as we chat with one another, then he finds out, as he says, when I think about a subject. So it doesn't mean that I'm just sitting there saying, yes, dear, because you know that I wouldn't be. I mean, we're just all human beings, and we have definite opinions. But as Ruth Graham said, that if two people agree on everything, one of them is unnecessary. And I think that that was a very wise saying. I think it's true, because it does not mean that because we submit or use that term or adapt, that we don't have any opinion about a thing. One scripture that was a help to me when we first started out was 1 Corinthians 11:3. And let me just read it to you. You don't have to look at it. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a woman is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Now, if I want to be a godly woman and a godly wife, I will take a verse like that, and I will take verses out of Ephesians 5 and really pay attention to what God has to say. And I remember chatting with one of the other wives about this, and she gave a good example. Let's say, for instance, that we do have a decision to make whether or not to buy a carpet. So we discuss what we should do. Well, let's say we differ, and I think one thing, Ed thinks another. But the ultimate decision is his. So I say, well, okay, I mean, according to the Word of God, this is what I am to do. Now, that does not mean that I'm still, you know, in agreement. I have disagreed, and he knows it, but he feels that this is what we should do. Well, what does the verse say? It says that the head of every man is Christ. And if Ed makes a mistake, I go scot-free, so to speak. In other words, the decision is his. If he's made a mistake, then he lives with it. But now he's not trying to get out of the will of God. He's not trying to make mistakes for us as a couple. But I find that this is a really helpful, practical outlook. And I think that some of you wives who've already learned this, you know, leave yourself open to younger wives coming along. Because as Ed says, this is one of the major areas in our lives, this relationship with one another. If we get that thing settled, then it helps in our in all the other areas, and especially then when children come along. And I feel that if you have learned some of the lessons, that you just open the door a little bit to other people in conversation. This is what I find, that when I share with other wives, I'll just push the door open a little bit in my life, and give them an example. Or one of the wives in England, when before they got married, I think she used to look at us and think, you know, they never have any disagreements over anything, you know, and they never seem to go through the same things that I'm going through already before we're married. And I used to take upstate examples and give an instance of where Ed had said something or where he had done something, and I'd, you know, kind of needled about it. But the idea is you forbear with one another. Doesn't mean that you're always in agreement with everything he says or does, but you forbear as a Christian, not just as a submissive wife. And so I feel that this is helpful, that we let the door open in our lives and we share with others some of the things that we up-to-date, things that we've gone through, and it really is a help.
Thank you, dear. Now, on the spiritual leadership of the children, and here the wife has a responsibility as well as the husband. And so I've got a few points I would just like to suggest. The first thing is pray for your children, both husband and wife. Pray for them. I mean that in the sense of committing them to God at some point, and we did that before our children were born, so that we were taking our hands off our children. And then praying for their improvement. And I feel this verse that I read yesterday, or day before yesterday when I spoke, 2 Corinthians 13, 7, 8, and 9. 2 Corinthians 13, 7, 8, and 9. Where Paul, praying for his spiritual children, says, I pray that you will not do wrong. Not that I may appear to have met a test or lived up to a standard, but in order that you may do what is right, even though it may look like I have failed. For we can do nothing against the truth. We are glad when we are weak and you are strong, for what we pray for is your improvement. And I feel that sort of selfless prayer for your children is the first step in really leading them and helping them grow up, not just spiritually, but just as normal, well-adjusted human beings. But to pray selflessly for their improvement, even if people think you've done a poor job, that you know God is helping them do right, even though some of the things they may do might look like maybe you failed. Well, that's not important. The main thing is their improvement. Second thing is be an example. Be an example. Now, somewhere I've jotted down a passage, and I think this is where I want to use it. It's, I think, very important, so I think I will use it here in just a moment. The problem we have with being an example is we realize how far short we fall of God's standard, or how imperfect we are, and so whenever anyone says, be an example to your children, you think of all the mistakes you've made, and you automatically sense, well, that rules me out of helping my children. But I don't think that's true. I think the important thing, if you feel you are not a perfect example, is to admit it, so that your children know that, and to basically just be honest, be an honest example. The verse I wanted to use was Hebrews chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. And I think this is very important in the whole area of leadership, whether it's the husband and wife, parents and children, employer and employee, minister and people, church minister, pastor and people. Hebrews 2, 10 and 11. It was right and proper that he for whom and by whom all things exist, meaning God, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through suffering. Now that used to bother me, because how could the pioneer of our salvation, Jesus, be more perfect than perfect? I mean, we know that he was perfect, that he was sinless. And that always used to bother me. How could suffering make Jesus more perfect?
till I read it in the J.B. Phillips translation. It was right and proper that in bringing many sons to glory, God, through whom and by whom everything exists, should make the leader of their salvation a perfect leader through the fact that he suffered. Now that began to make sense.
Jesus was perfect, but in being perfect, he was not a very good leader. Does that offend you? The more perfect you are, the worse you are as a leader, really. One of the important things for a leader is that he's within sight so he can be followed. If you give your children the impression that you're perfect, that you never make any mistakes, you're not helping them, you're frustrating them. As I think of the eternal Son of God, sinless, powerful, transcendent over all the universe, I can't see anything to follow. That I'm so far behind, I won't even take the first step because he's just too far out in front. But the fact that Jesus Christ went through this suffering, not just on the cross, but his whole suffering of hungering and thirsting, his whole human suffering, weeping over the death and the weeping that the people were doing over death in John 11, that made Jesus a more followable leader. When we went to Africa, I almost got trapped. In fact, I did make some mistakes early on because I was 26 years old and I was working with African men who were years older than I was. And my first thought was, well, now I can't make any mistakes because I'm the missionary, I'm the leader. And if I make mistakes, I would cover it up because these men will not respect me. They will not follow me. And I found just the opposite was true. I was just setting, you know, a very dishonest standard, first of all, and secondly, one that they couldn't follow. They knew that I was not for real. And it was when I began to admit, yes, well, I made a mistake here and I made a mistake there, I found that they began to follow. And I didn't lose their respect, but I gained it. So with your children, be an example. Don't frustrate them by nagging. Lead them, but don't drive them. Ephesians 6:4, just write these references down, and I'll read Ephesians 6:4. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And one translation says, don't overcorrect your children. Don't nag them. Genesis 18:19. Now, I think we should read these because I think the Word of God is more important than anything really that I'm saying. Genesis 18:19. No, for I have chosen him, this is Abraham, that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. And I find right there those little words that I know Abraham, that he will charge his children and his household after him. And that's to me just a picture of Abraham. God knew that Abraham would charge his children, but that he would lead them and not just preach at them. And then just write down 2 Timothy 1:5. Okay, third point, prayer, example, and then under the family, start building a relationship with your children. If you haven't already, if they're already teenagers, it's probably too late, except for the grace of God. But with some of the younger
couples that you know, encourage them to start building a relationship right
before the kid's born even.
But even right after the children are born, begin talking to them. Begin paying attention to them. Begin touching them. Begin cuddling them. And this is just on a physical level.
Even before you begin to communicate with them spiritually about the Lord
and the Christian life, you need to begin communicating to them just as people. Get used to talking to them. make your communication a way of life. Just as a parent with his child, while they're still children, babies. Then when it comes time to talk to them about spiritual things, you'll find the transition very easy. But it has to begin early in order to make it a lifetime communication. It means taking time with them when they come home from school, listening to what's been going on. And dads and mothers, I think it's the same. Now, when my kids came home from school, they didn't really say anything very important. It was really just a lot of nonsense. But boy, you've got to listen. Because when they are teenagers and they're coming home and they're talking about other kids taking drugs, those are the things that mean something. That's not nonsense. That's when you want them to talk. That's when they're going to say things that are meaningful. And that's why it's important that you listen to them when they're not saying anything. Because that's going to keep that door of communication open when they grow up and begin talking about meaningful things. And the pattern does continue into the teens. And this has been a joy with our kids. I listened to an awful lot of just nonsense when they were little. But now that they're talking about this friend of my son's, and he says, well, this friend has been taking drugs and he's been drinking a lot, and he's decided to quit. Well, boy, my ears perk up, and I thought, boy, am I glad Mark told me that. Because now I know how to pray for this boy and how to pray for Mark. And so many times I've heard of kids who just come home and they don't talk to their parents when they're teenagers. They close the door and that's it. Well, I think we've got to start when they're children. And it's important here that you not have negative first reactions, that your first reactions when your kids begin telling you things, your first reactions are not negative. Now, this is where I need a lot of help from the expert child rearer in our family, Ruth. Because 9 times out of 10, when Mark comes home or Paula, and they say, I'm going to buy a motorcycle. Oh, no, you're not. You know, right away, no. Instead of saying, well, you know, and listening, and why, and talking about it. Because, you know, a kid, when you respond negatively for 5 or 6 or 7 times, after a while, it just turns them down and down and then off. And they're not going to talk to you about it. Doesn't mean you agree with what they're going to do, but let your first reactions be positive. Be interested and listen to them. But beware of those first negative reactions. Well, I've got a lot more to say on this, but I'm going to have to skip over it. I want to say one thing that really helped me. Deuteronomy 6:5-7, under this idea of building a relationship. Deuteronomy 6:5-7. We've not been very successful as a family at having family devotions. I hope you're not too disillusioned. And it bothered me until last April. I was in Brazil, and Jim Peterson and I were down on the beach, and we were talking about this. And he said, I feel that our children's spiritual training should be part of our whole way of life. It should be coherent with the way we live. That our spiritual conversations should be part of life. And he said he feels this is what Deuteronomy 6:5-7 is saying. And we read it together, and it really makes sense to me. Deuteronomy 6:5-7. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be upon your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign and so forth. Sometimes family devotions, quote, can just be a conscience easer. And we think, well, now I'm giving my children their spiritual training because we read the Bible at breakfast and we had a time of prayer. And that can be just something that eases your conscience. I've known families that do this religiously. And it actually means nothing to the children, and they do it even when there are tensions in the family. And this is supposed to come as kind of a thing to put everything right, and it doesn't. And it seems to me this passage is saying, look, teach your kids when you're riding to school with them. When they're coming home, when you're walking home together, when you're on a Saturday out working in the garden, when you're putting them to bed. And that's when kids are asking questions. That's when they want to talk. Well, then is the time to discuss spiritual things with them. When you're lying down, when you're rising up, when you're walking by the way. Part of your whole life. Don't fit God into that time of the morning when you read the Bible. I'm not saying you shouldn't have a devotional time. I really wish we could, because I feel it can set the tone for the whole day. But don't put God into that corner and not teach your children spiritual things during the rest of the day. And I found that my kids have learned more through that sort of teaching and training than they would have had we just had the devotional time and that's all. But be ready to teach them. You know, Mark, for instance, we have a little saying. We'll look at a flower, or we'll look at some animal and the way they live, and we'll say, now, isn't it amazing how God gave that baby lamb the instinct to go for the mother and to get the milk from the mother? Now, who taught him that? And so we've said that from time to time, and we'll look at a flower, and we'll see its design and its intricacy, and, you know, well, now, who made that way? And after a while, Mark says, yeah, I know. Well, I feel that this is a spiritual training that can be done just when you're walking along, when you're doing the normal things of life. Okay, fourth point after this relationship is built. And it's just this, and I'm going to give it as a heading. Early control, shared control, self-control. Being a spiritual leader does not mean that you always make all the decisions. There is, first of all, control. Then you begin to share that control with your children. And we faced it now with our daughter. She is in London for the month of August. She's supposed to start the University of Colorado in the autumn. And in a phone call just before she left for London, she left from Minneapolis, she said, I'm thinking about working next year instead of going to university. And my first reaction, oh, no, you're not. See, there it is again, that negative first reaction. And so Ruth is there patting me on the shoulder, you know, which is her way of saying, now, wait a minute. Remember what you preach. And so she said, because I let her talk a little, she said, well, I'm praying about it, and, you know, I'll try to do what's right. And I feel, well, there's a time when I can give advice, and we kind of share the control. Well, she's 19, 20, living away from me. It's completely her control. 1 Samuel 3:13 might be a reference that you would write down, because Samuel did not restrain his children. Eli did not restrain his children. 1 Samuel 3:13 in their early days. And so when it came time for them to control themselves, they had none. Fifth point, very briefly, answer their questions very fully while they are young. And encourage them to ask questions. I don't think that our leadership should be the kind where we say, jump, and they say, how high? I think when a child begins to ask why, we should not stifle it, but we should encourage it, especially in matters of their faith. Where did Cain get his wife? If I were able, I would tell you. I think we need to be growing if we're going to answer our kids' questions, and this compares to what I was saying the other day. Read. Your kids are going to ask questions you never even thought of. You need to begin reading and studying more about what's going on in the world so that you can help your kids and give them reasonable answers. 1 Peter 3:15 and Acts 18:4-5. Paul did not just give pat answers, but he argued and he reasoned with them from the scriptures. And I think it's important that you take the time with your children.
I was in Cambridge speaking to a young student, and we spent about 3 hours,
I spent 3 hours answering his questions about the Bible and about God. And after that, I was on my way home on the train, 1 Peter 3:15 and Acts 18, 4 and 5. On the train on the way home, just before I left, I said, "By the way, how old are you, Roger?" And he said, 16. And on the train, I was reflecting on our conversation, and I remembered, 16. My daughter is 16. When was the last time I spent 3 hours answering her questions? Well, there hadn't been many times. I'd never done it. And yet I'll travel, 3 hours by train to talk to somebody else's kid for 3 hours, and then not have time to answer my own children's questions. And it's important here, just as a final point on children and your leadership of them, they're people too. Not only is your wife a person, but your kids are people. And you shouldn't really behave any less patiently, any less considerately toward them than you do toward other people's children or other adults. They are people. We need to give them tolerance. We need to forbear them. We need to give them understanding. We need to be sensitive to them, with them. And we need to have wisdom in helping them, just as much as we do other people's children.